So all month, I've been bringing in, as a way to start us here at the new studio, just some aspects of the discussion of how yoga, as we understand it, often thinking about yoga as a movement practice, but also going back to it as a breath practice, and kind of Hindu lineage meditation practices, devotional practices, and what we think of as Buddhist practices. Nowadays, we mostly think about meditation for that, but as we've looked at these two traditions that have both had meditation practices, have both had physical practices, have both had breath practices, devotional practices, and in many ways, for the first 1,000 years of their existence, yoga and Buddhism birthed at about the same time, the two traditions were completely interwoven, really not diverging into fully separate religions for many centuries. And so they have many, many deep characteristics in common. We talked initially about the practice orientation toward embodiment, this way we might understand that one of the things that's most valuable for us in practice now, for moderns, in a very technology-heavy, speed-heavy, distraction-heavy culture, consumer culture, that anything we can do to reconnect the sense of ourselves as thought and feeling with the sense of ourselves as body and sensation is valuable. So these are the embodiment practices. And yoga in physical postures can help that. Deepening the breath, arriving into breath can help that. Relaxation practices can help that. And the focus and concentration practices that are emphasized in meditation can help that. All of these support an orientation toward spiritual practice, not as a transcendent or leaving the body or escaping the earth kind of way, but living more fully into our bodies, our relationships, and the ecosystem that we share. We talked about energy, and how, again, both of these traditions, what you can call the Buddhist and Hindu yogas, plural, have teachings on cultivating energy in the body, what we call energy, different descriptions for how, as meditation or devotion or cultivation of various kinds matures, sensation and that feels like movement, that feels like vibration, that feels like force or intensity, can awaken in the body in quite a full way. And the traditions approach these energies a little bit differently, but both talk about their value on the path, and also that they are not the goal of practice. In all of the systems, liberation is the goal, but that energy in the body is both valuable, beautiful, pleasurable, and supportive on the path. And so, I want to talk tonight a little bit historically, and put a little kind of context around some of the practices that we do. Continuing to hopefully flesh out in a way some of what it might mean or how it might transform us to be involved in these traditions. We think of yoga as a practice of stringing postures together or taking postures with clear alignment as an ancient form. In some ways, some aspects of it are, particularly the ascetic aspects of the yoga tradition. Putting the body in uncomfortable situations in order to burn up karma is perhaps a 3,000-year-old tradition or longer. And the meditative positions, certainly seated meditation postures, are 2,500 to 3,000 years old. And as they evolved, some of the newer practices that came in, mantra and visualization, devotion to deities arrived. And somewhere about, you know, 1,000 years or so ago, other postures besides the sitting postures start to be described in the context of yoga practice. So the practice of taking multiple postures as part of yoga is not the most ancient thread of yoga by any means. It's perhaps the newest thread, but it starts maybe 1,000 years or so ago. And over the centuries, as what we call Hatha Yoga develops, more and more postures are added to the body of postures that are considered yoga. Until by the 17th or 18th century, there are lists of 84 postures, 100 and some postures. But they still omitted many, many of the postures we do today in normal studio yoga classes in the States and the West. Or in the Indian traditions that became westernized, what we call the Iyengar and Ashtanga traditions, the Shivananda tradition, etc. These traditions have different postures. So where did they come from? One of the acknowledged kind of bottlenecks or the sources of many of these practices, the compiler, not the inventor, I would say, of many of them, but the gatherer of many of these practices was a Sanskrit scholar and teacher in Mysore in the 1920s named Tirumalai Krishnamacharya. And he was hired by the Maharaja, or the king of Mysore, the kingdom of Mysore, to teach yoga to the king's family. So he moved into the palace and he began teaching to the king's family. And after a little while, he got some funding to open the first, we could say, modern yoga school, the Yoga Shala, in Mysore in 1933. And its pupils were teenage boys, primarily. He emphasized for these young boys the performance of complicated postures, and they would go around and perform postures like a circus almost, and it was a little circus like. The pictures of them are they look very much like you would imagine a kind of early 20th century, late Victorian kind of contortion show to look like. Very skinny young boys in deep back bends, often in partner poses, balancing on each other. Things that looked good. And it's interesting to think that modern yoga begins with this performance quality. And we can sort of flash forward kind of just nearly 100 years from that and look at many, you know, just scroll through Instagram. And we find ourselves again in the kind of the performance or observing at least the performance of complicated contortion. Krishnamacharya was in part influenced by Victorian contortionists, as well as Swedish and British gymnastics, particularly the physical exercises of the YMCA that the Christians had brought to India under the good British Protestant doctrine that strength was godly. And so if the Indians exercised, it would make them more easy to convert to becoming Christian. It didn't work. Mm-hmm. And instead, the Indians just borrowed the exercises, which were good, and turned them into yoga. Take that, YMCA. So Krishnamacharya puts together this physical practice based on many things that he studied with his teachers. And also, he was an innovator, and he brought in these various forms. And one of the justifications he used for bringing them in was that under the British colonial system, the Indian people there was talk of the time that the Indian people were kind of weak and easy to dominate, easy to govern, because they didn't stand up for themselves much. There wasn't really a rebellion movement at the time. Gandhi hadn't really shown up yet. It was just starting. And so one of the justifications for asana in the early years was as a resistance to British colonialism. That if through this practice the Indians could become strong and a little bit more military, they would be able to eventually defend themselves and push back against this colonial force. So that's a thread in an interesting way of resistance to a political domination at the heart of early modern yoga. Krishnamacharya's most famous students were BKS Iyengar, who founded the Iyengar School, and Patabi Joyce, who founded the Ashtanga School, and Krishnamacharya's own son, Deskachar, who, along with his students, was the source of the Vinaya Yoga School. So that lineage, the Krishnamacharya lineage, is responsible for much of the profusion of yoga in the West. And sometimes that's called the Southern School, where there's a parallel northern influence, which is the students of Swami Shivananda, including Satchidananda and Satyananda, the founders of the Integral and Bihar and Shivananda schools, that brought a very different kind of yoga to the West, much more devotional, much more quote-unquote Hindu, fewer postures, more mantra, more devotion. And the northern school was Shaiva, oriented toward Shiva as primary deity, where the southern school was at least nominally Vaishnava, oriented toward Vishnu. So let's jump over the imaginary border to Buddhism. And the British, of course, colonized not just India, but Burma. And they made a go at Thailand, but didn't succeed. No one succeeded in colonizing Thailand, a success for which the Thai are still proud. Everyone around them got colonized by the French, the Dutch, the British, and the Thai resisted. But Burma succumbed to British colonialism, again in the late 19th century. And at the time, Buddhism in Burma was purely monastic and not meditative. It was very study-oriented. It was oriented toward memorizing very complex lists of topics called the Abhidhamma, or the deep structures of the teachings. And when the British armies came up the river and took over the capital of Rangoon, Yangon, which the British renamed Rangoon, without a fight, the British monastic establishment was frightened, recognizing that this could mean the end of Buddhism in Burma, that the colonial power could destroy the in some ways strong, but in some other ways fragile, web of support between the lay people and the monastics they supported through generosity. And so there were a couple of reformers, a couple of monks, who said, what can we do to preserve Buddhism in Burma? And one of the ideas was to make it much more popularly practiced. In other words, to get lay people to practice, not just monastics. And one of the reformers that started this off was a monk named Ledi Sayadaw. And he began a movement in Burma to get lay people to study the deep teachings more. And that led to, particularly in a couple of students of his, the beginnings of offering meditation practices to non-monks. So the beginning of what we now call like Vipassana, the 10-day retreat of Goenka, and insight meditation in the West, all of these forms of going on an intensive retreat, like I hope you will come on with me in January. All of this begins not in the time of the Buddha, but in, you know, the early to mid 20th century, where these Buddhist reformist monks correctly guessed that if they could turn the entire population of Burma into meditators, it would be impossible to destroy Buddhism there. Not just meditators, but really the people who studied the texts. And so a big program of popularization, and of course some of these efforts were not popular, were not well received, particularly by other monastics. It has not always been popular to offer teachings on meditation and liberation to non-monks and nuns. This has been true in yoga as well as Buddhism. So interestingly, and so Ledi's students and the next couple generations included teachers like Mahasi Sayadaw and Ubakin Sayadaw, whose student was Goenka, who started the very famous 10-day Vipassana retreats that some of you have been on. And Mahasi is my grandfather teacher through my teacher, my teachers Jack Kornfield and others who studied with him. And he invented one of the most popular forms of Vipassana also to come to the West. So I want to just sort of, without even saying exactly what it means, just note that it was colonial threat that caused both yoga and Buddhism to be developed into popular practices that could be transmitted easily to a lot of people. And that both of those things happened in the early 20th century and were largely reinventions. Before Buddhism was reinvented in Burma, I'd said that not a lot of folks were practicing meditation. They were practicing other things, study and service, but not so much meditation. And the same was happening in Thailand. Even though it wasn't colonized, not a lot of monks were practicing meditation. But in the early 20th century, a couple of visionary monks, particularly one named Ajahn Mun, who was a fierce, very powerful meditator who lived up near the Lao border in northeastern Thailand. And he was known for walking through the wilderness where there were tigers, where no one else would go, living in caves that were known to be haunted, teaching forest spirits and gods, devas, any number of what we would call supernatural powers. And some of his students were among the great Thai meditation masters of the century. Again, including in my, these are, I'm naming them partly because I know them well, they're my lineage. Again, through my teacher Jack, who studied with Ajahn Chah, who studied with Ajahn Mun, a line to that lineage. And so these practices that came to us, that have come down to us now in the form of mindfulness, which is like the absolutely most simplified, popular, practicable version of Buddhist meditation there maybe ever was. You don't even need Buddhism to practice it. Is a direct line from these early 20th century inventors or reformers who revived practice often by inventing stuff. None of the forms of Vipassana we do now, in the exact types of meditation, were being done before the 20th century. None of the forms of yoga that we do now, almost none, were being done in the way that we do them. None were being done in the way that we do them, in these kinds of spaces, in these kinds of choreographed sequences, all together in a group, unison, inhale, lift your arms, exhale, and fold. That's a new invention. And interesting that in both of the Burma and India cases, they were both in part conditioned by the presence of the colonial occupation. So this is a way of saying that I have arguments a lot with people, unfortunately mostly on Facebook nowadays, which is really kind of unpleasant and kind of amazing because I suddenly have friends in Toronto and Oslo and you know, New Zealand and Mexico who I have these conversations with. It's amazing. I never would have met them or conversed with them otherwise. But the argument side, when we get into disagreeing, is not pleasant. But so many of these arguments hinge, in a way, on conversations that have been happening in both the yoga and Buddhist worlds for a while now, at least a decade or so. The conversation has been really hot about, like, what is real practice? What are the origins of practice? Whose practice is older, right? Because in all of these traditions, there is a way that, like, older is more authentic, which isn't true, but there is an aspect of that in Indian tradition. Throughout the history of yoga, every time somebody invented something new, they would say, I know the method sounds new, but it'll get you to the state that the sages of old described. And they would say that again and again, century after century, that tantric people said, this will just accomplish what Patanjali, the classical yoga teacher, was trying to accomplish. And then later, the hatha yogis would say, this is just getting you to accomplish what Patanjali was trying to accomplish. And now we come to a modern yoga class where we're jumping through vinyasa forms, really heating the body, opening the ligaments and the joints through strong muscular movement, and then taking resting poses where we bring mindfulness to the body and its vibrating energies. It's a beautiful practice. And I guarantee you, every week in this studio, some teacher among the, you know, several dozen classes says, in doing this, we get, you know, we open towards something of what Patanjali, that ancient sage, was suggesting we do, or the Buddha was suggesting we do. And it's so interesting that we have these practices that are so new, but that have a thread that traces back so far, but that have been reinvented over and over and over. So I hope that one of the things this means to you is that it's that you don't have to have arguments with people about whose practice is older and more authentic. Mm-hmm. I hope I will never have that argument again. Certain practices are older than others, and practice gets reinvented all the time. And for me, it just feels important to know where things come from. I want to know when I'm in a yoga class that, you know, when I do a certain kind of forward fold, Paschimottanasana, the stretching the west side of the body or the back side of the body, that I'm doing one of the oldest yoga poses. It appears in the 14th and 15th century texts. Or that when I come into a seated posture like this, I'm taking perhaps the oldest yogic practice of them all, settling the body in stillness and drawing my attention inward. And then I want to know when I'm on my back doing some crunches, because core stabilization is really good for computer-driven yogis like myself and many of us, that I'm not doing something ancient, that I'm doing something more or less invented by Joseph Pilates, the German bodybuilder who came to New York and founded a gym in the 1950s. And that doesn't mean it's not useful. It's actually probably more useful than the forward fold for many yogis. So this then is an interesting question of so many questions. What I orient toward most is I want to find for myself and my students when we talk about practice, I want to find what's most useful to do. And that means for you, what's going to be healing? What's going to open your heart? What is going to clarify the habits of neurotic thought that trouble you? The habits of anxiety and fear and frustration and worry and shutdown and overwhelm? What's going to clarify, on a deeper level, perhaps, existential doubt, self-hatred, the sense of not knowing what our purpose is or why we're here or what it even means to be alive, what it means to be in a body that we know will die, even if we refuse to think about that? And so I no longer say to people, you know, that meditation is a good thing for everyone to do. Right? Because there's some folks for whom it's not that helpful. Right? Sometimes folks will come up to me and they say, you know, I wanna learn to meditate. I'm a mess. And I'm like, what kind of a mess are you? And, you know, and they're like, well, I'm really depressed. I've kind of lost my spark for life. I don't really have any friends. And I'm like, cool. For that flavor of mess, don't meditate. Going inward into your inner dark space is totally wrong medicine for that. I want you to go out take a brisk walk or a jog or get on the treadmill or whatever, do something, move your body every day a little bit. Go to the farmer's market where there's lots of people. Talk to a couple of them, you know. If you want to sit in stillness, sit out in stillness like on a park bench where there's kids playing around and dogs. Like, get out, move the body. So, like, what's the medicine for the ailment? And I'll call that better yoga. And maybe I'll be like, go to a gentle yoga class, but don't sit in stillness, right? Move the body in the company of people. For someone else who's like, you know, whatever, there's all the different ailments. So meditation is a medicine. And the Buddha was called, even in his time, the great physician. He was considered to be one who prescribed medicine for ailments. And when he talked to lay people, like non-monastics, he mostly didn't prescribe meditation. He said, be really generous, take care of other people, be kind, don't cause harm, support the monastics, come and hear the teachings, be a good family person, essentially, a good person in your community. And then if you want to come and be a monastic, then, you know, settle your affairs, take care of your family, come and be a monastic, and then, you know, if you go and be a monk or a nun, very often the first thing you'll be told to do is, okay, now, you know, sweep the walk, take care of the visitors, you know, clean the temple, polish the statues. And my friends who are monks are like, very often an enthusiastic young guy comes into the monastery, I totally did this, and is like, I want to go into deep solitary practice right away. You know, I hear you guys do caves. I want to do a cave. And that kid, and this was me, would be told like, yeah, cave eventually. First, kitchen work. You know, and you're there with a whole bunch of other people chopping vegetables or sweeping up and I'm mopping up the floor and I'm like, is this what I signed up for? I can't quite tell. Because it was the right medicine, right? It's not the right medicine to send that kid off to a cave. And so we have so many tools available to us as modern yogis, and not just postures and meditation and breath work, but so many things. And I want us to now be like, oh, these big tools, meditation and yoga, were reinvented to serve the needs of a certain population of people, and they serve many of us very well. But in addition to that, there's just more, right? Therapy does things that meditation and yoga can never do. Exercise does things that even yoga can't do. Study does things that neither can do. Getting politically active or socially active does things that neither can do. Probably the best medicine that is hard to prescribe, because for people who don't have it, it sounds like it sort of turns the knife to even prescribe it, but is have good friends. It's probably the most healthy thing any human nervous system can do, is have people that you can connect with directly. And if you don't have that, it can be tremendously painful, and if you really don't have it, it's profoundly destabilizing, ultimately. Sometimes I think the most spiritual thing about the modern yoga class is that it's communal, that we do it together. So, I'll pause there. May we practice with discernment, with all of the tools and methods available to us. Remaining awake to the distinct suffering of each student, of each of us, and approach the path of liberation with a kind of creativity and brightness. So, thanks for listening. And any thoughts from you? Anything you want to add to this, or curiosities about the history, or really anything about your own practice? And take a little bit here. Yeah, Jen.
Speaking of all the tools we have available to us, I think get kind of caught up trying to prescriber of my own medicine.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out then which one to take at a given moment, for a given month, for a given season, whatever I'm trying
totally.
To choose. And I think part of the reason I struggle to commit to it, maybe, is because I'm not convinced I know the best medicine for myself.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I'm like, well, maybe that, you know.
Totally. This is a great question, right? How do you prescribe practices to yourself? Traditionally, you wouldn't.
Right.
You would go to your teacher, your guru, your you know, your acharya, you'd be like, here's my ailment, what should I do? I mean, this is so funny, right? I was going to say, it's not like I go to my doctor and I say, here's the medicine I want to take, but of course, this is what modern pharmaceutical advertisement asks me to do all the time. Ask your doctor if Zazafec will be good for you, you know. And of course the doctor's like, well, I don't. They paid me to sell it to you, so of course it's good for you. But it's difficult to know, and it takes some discernment. I would say mostly it takes a kind of like maturity on the path. It's a little bit like if I was. If I was presented with just like a whole bunch of lumber and piles of screws and nuts and bolts and clamps and things and a toolbox full of hammers and wrenches and ratchets and drills, and I was told, make a cabinet, I'd be like, And I'd sort of look at all, and I'd be like, before I even do that, I have to know what all these things do. I have to like drill a bunch of holes to even learn what the drill does, and hammer some nails to even learn how to use the hammer. So I don't think we can really self-prescribe accurately until we've been doing it for, I don't know, don't quote me on this, 10 years? Maybe? Just a guess. Maybe quicker if you're a quick learner. It took me a long time. We just have to sort of learn our tools. So I think it's fine to try stuff, you know, to just be like, what does this do? And do it and see. But particularly with the things that are like subtle and emotional, like working on my own energy or my own sort of emotional states, it's very hard to see those clearly until I really get used to observing them. And so then it's hard to prescribe things, because when we're beginners, I think we can't really tell the difference between what might just make it feel better in the moment and what's actually a medicine to get at the underlying illness, right? So like if I'm depressed and I'm just looking for something that'll make it feel better, well, a drink might make it feel better. But that's not actually good medicine, ultimately. You know, a drink of alcohol. So, I mean, maybe for, you know. But like, you know what I mean? So it's hard. It's hard to do that, and so some guidance, so teacher, therapist, senior student, like somebody who's been doing it a long time, and then a little trial and error. You know that something has succeeded if it both feels like it works, doesn't have any side effects that you can notice, bad side effects that you can tell, doesn't break any ethical boundaries that you have, and you're not embarrassed to tell your family that you did it. It's maybe that's a good little set of guidelines. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah. And
You seem quite determined that when you do, if you're very depressive, and to do meditation, or you wouldn't recommend to do meditation. And like when you talk about like having a toolkit, I feel like meditation have been my primary tool to overcome like some of the most the biggest crisis in my life.
Totally.
Of course not standing alone, but it have been something that I could rely on as something I know that works for me.
Yeah, totally.
So I was just curious why you wouldn't
Yeah.
take it into like a toolkit for F, depressed.
Yeah. Well, and I say it in an interesting way. If I was going to diagnose myself, depression is probably the closest thing I would come up with also for many years. And meditation was my primary tool as well. But maybe I would ask, like, what do you think it was about having it as your like, steady, reliable practice that, that really served you? What was it about the practice that helped?
I think it was having something every day that could support me in kind of separating my thoughts and my emotions a bit.
Yeah.
And getting distance.
Yeah.
Kind of seeing myself a little bit from above.
Uh-huh.
And in the beginning, I was not at all able to do that.
Yeah.
But because I trusted so much in the power of meditation.
Yeah.
I think like one of the times I was in a very deep depression, it took me way shorter time to get through it.
Yeah.
Than it did like before I have gained
the knowledge of this. I'm so glad. Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. a couple of thoughts. I like that you're saying it because I don't want to sound too absolute when I say that. This really important piece of being able to kind of separate thought and emotion or to see that there are two different channels or aspects of what we're doing is huge. And in some ways, the reason why I often don't recommend it, and now I'd have to define it, right? What kind of meditation I don't recommend. Mostly, the deep kind of inwardness is the thing that I'm wary about. It's partly because of the sort of the way that you say, like, well, in the beginning, I really wasn't able to do it. And so I'm cautious that for some people, that might be further distressing. And that other kinds of practice, something that's a little bit more open or outwardly focused, might be more appropriate. But you mentioned a few things I think that I think really do support, you know, that supported you, particularly kind of, and this is subtle. I think it's a little special, perhaps. Not everyone has it. But you really trusted that that it would work. And I almost feel like that trust is what worked. Like in the swirl of confusion that depression can sometimes be, or the not having energy, or however it manifested for you, to have one thing that you could orient toward and be like, I trust this, or I believe in this, or I take refuge in this, is a lifeline. And so, you know, even if I might not prescribe in an abstract way, I don't prescribe kind of, oh, go inward, follow your breath, etc., to someone who's really struggling with those states. For someone who's doing them with that kind of orientation, like, I deeply trust it. Imagine that was some large part of why it really worked well for you. I would say for myself that, like, the meditation itself that I was doing, I don't know what it was really accomplishing. It was very hard for a very long time. But I also was really faithful. In my case, I really believed in the teachings of the Buddha. And I was just like, I might be the worst practitioner ever and totally miserable for my whole life, but I'm devoted to the Buddha. And maybe in a similar way, I would say, I think it's actually the devotion that pulled me through rather than the sitting itself. And the sitting was kind of the form that took. And that's one other thing I'll say, is that I say that teaching partly in relation to the forms of depression that are really like deep trauma. where like the nervous system is really shut down in a kind of profound way. And sometimes the tiniest shift of just like, it's like, well, just practice with your eyes open. Like rest in meditation, but rather than kind of falling inward, just kind of be open to the room. Can be enough to completely change it for someone and make it a beautiful practice for them. So I'm glad you said it. It's always useful for folks to be like, Sean, don't be so extreme. And I'm like, I think that's true. That's appropriate. I get excited. Yes, Lisa.
Well, I'm remembering I had therapy for depression in the 90s where I feel like I really realized that I was afraid of my emotions and my thoughts were scaring me and I had a lot of aversion to everything that was going on in here. And I gathered from meditation through a book of Pema Chodron, The Places That Scare You, the idea of going toward rather than away. And my particular therapist was saying to feel the feelings rather than try to be cured of the feelings. And so meditation, for me, had a commonality with that.
Yes.
And so the therapy of, Lisa, feel those feelings, don't try to cure yourself of them, that's what's causing the problem. Then that took me to the, you know, pay attention to what's going on without judgment, let the thoughts go. That was a pretty smooth transition
there.
And then, so because of that, I think I really, really trusted meditation because it so fit with this therapy that was so helpful for me.
Yeah, and the therapy supported the practice you were doing. They supported each other.
Yeah, the meditation practice came quite a bit later.
Uh-huh.
But I, you know, I remembered that I really trusted that idea of feeling my feelings, whereas before the therapy, I was terrified of my feelings. If I had any thought that I was going into depression, I would freak out and it would all get worse. So if I went ahead and felt that instead, then I was convinced from that therapy that that was what I really needed, and so then that was the end later on to taking up meditation.
Totally. That's great. So again, you had the conditions that enabled you in a way to do something in meditation that without those previous conditions might have been more difficult.
Right, definitely.
Yeah. So all of that in a way is to say, and I'll end with this, just to say that there's no... no prescription is right for everybody. Like, it's different for everyone. And even to say meditation, it doesn't mean just one thing. The entire tradition is meditation in a certain way. And it's different if we're saying, you know, do these visualizations or you know, work with energy or work with your breath or work with sounds or work with, you know, just relaxing. And they'll all have a slightly different kind of tone in the nervous system or the being, the minds. Mind bodies of the people doing them. So, cool. So, that finishes our month of talking about the crossover between the traditions. I'm not sure what we'll talk about next. So, so stay tuned. And as always, this group is offered in the ancient practice of the gift economy. So the circle is open always to everyone, no matter the resources you bring. And then the practice of sharing your resources is really a gift to support the sustaining of the circle. So your generosity enables the studio and myself to continue making this space available. And in a way that makes it possible for others and folks of many different kinds of means to attend. So as generous as you can be, really supports us in that way. So thank you for that. Now that we're in the new space, resources, money, donations can be offered both in cash in the little painted box in the stereo cabinet, next to which is a mailing list if you're not on mine and you want to be. Leave me info there, Donations can also be made at the desk in credit card or class pass form or things like that. So thanks for your presence. Thanks for hanging out with a little bit of history tonight and onward. So, blessings. Stay cool this week. Yeah.
Feel better.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, yikes.